Stories of Journey to the West, Chapter 67.
The Tang Monk, Sun Wukong, the Monkey King, Zubaji, Pigsy, and Sha Wujing, they're traveling west.
Just left small western heaven behind them.
And it's late spring. Everything's blooming. Looks quite nice, actually.
Deceptively nice, maybe.
Huh, maybe. But evening's coming on, and, you know, basic need, shelter.
Right, and straight away you get that clash of personalities.
Oh, yeah. Wukong's all confidence, isn't he?
Totally. He's basically joking, like, oh, if we can't find a place, I'll just prop up the sky with my staff, build us something. Typical Wukong boast.
His staff could hold up the sky if it fell, yeah.
But then you have Zubaji.
Pigsy. Always practical. Mm-hmm. Or maybe just anxious.
Anxious, yeah. Worried about, and he lists them, tigers, leopards, wolves, and monsters. The real dangers of being out at night.
So it immediately shows there are different ways of dealing with, well, anything difficult. Mm. Wukong's like, I'll magic my way through. And Bashi's like, but what about the wolves?
Precisely. It's that core conflict. Wukong's almost divine power versus Baji's very human fears. You almost feel sorry for the Tang Monk caught between them sometime.
Definitely. Okay, so dusk is settling in. And finally they see it. A mountain village.
Ah, salvation. Or so they think.
Right. Not quite. So the Tang Monk, he goes up and knocks on this gate. It's shut tight.
And an old man answers. Just plainly dressed, black turban, carrying a staff. Looks like a regular villager.
And the monk does his usual polite introduction, you know. Greetings, I'm a humble monk from the east, heading west for scriptures. Could we possibly impose for a night's lodging?
Very proper.
But the old man's reaction is grim. Mm. He basically says, you're going to the great western heaven. That's incredibly far. And even just getting past here is difficult.
Ominous. And this is where we get the first real warning about a specific obstacle.
Yeah, he mentions a place about 30 lis west of the village. What's the line again?
About half a kilometer, roughly. So maybe 15 kilometers away. Not far, but far enough.
And the place is called Seven Absolutes Mountain.
Seven Absolutes Mountain, yeah. And the old man's fear, it's not just like stranger danger. It sounds like real local knowledge of something genuinely bad.
Okay, so Seven Absolutes Mountain. Hmm. Sounds impressive, maybe a bit scary. What makes it so bad? Why is it so hard to pass?
Well, that's the twist. The old man starts by describing something that should be wonderful.
Okay.
He says it's huge. 800 laid long.
800, so 400 kilometers. That's massive.
Enormous, and it's completely covered, just choked with persimmon trees.
Persimmon trees, okay. Sounds fruity.
Exactly. And he lists the seven absolutes, the seven great things about these trees. You know, they help you live long, give great shade, birds don't nest in them, no insects bother them.
Oh. Interesting.
Their leaves look beautiful with frost. The fruit's delicious. Big branches and leaves. Sounds like paradise, right? Perfect abundance.
It really does. So where's the catch? What's the difficult to pass part?
Ah, well, that's where it gets unit. And yeah, pretty gross.
Okay, I'm ready. Hit me.
The old man explains that every single year, all those delicious persimmons, they get ripe and they fall. Tons and tons of them.
Right. Natural cycle.
But they fall into this narrow stone alleyway. The only path through the mountain range.
Oh, okay. I see where this might be going.
You know, they completely fill it up and then they rot. Rain, dew, snow, summer heat. Mm. It all just turns this path into, well, the text calls it filth.
Filth. Okay. How bad are we talking?
The locals have a name for it. They call it the rare persimmon pain.
Rare persimmon pain.
Or more colloquially, rare shit pain.
Oh, wow. Okay. They don't mince words.
Not at all. In the description, the smell is apparently worse than an outhouse, especially when the west wind blows it towards the village.
Ugh.
Luckily for them, it's spring, so the wind's from the southeast. They can't smell it yet.
Small mercies. But still, a 400-kilometer path of rotting fruit, that's quite the obstacle.
It really grounds the journey, doesn't it? It's not just epic magic battles. Sometimes it's just wading through centuries of putrid persimmons.
So how does the group react to this lovely piece of news? The Tang Monk must be horrified.
Oh, absolutely distressed. You can picture him. But Wukong.
Let me guess. Not patient.
Not even slightly. He just loses it. Starts shouting at the poor old man.
What did he say?
Accuses him of trying to scare them off or just being mean and unwelcoming. And then he throws a bit of a tantrum like, fine, if you won't let us in, we'll just sleep under a tree.
Classic Wukong. All power, zero patience sometimes.
But then the old man does something pretty amazing.
Yeah.
He's clearly scared of Wukong. I mean, Wukong isn't exactly known for his conventional good looks.
Statement.
But despite being terrified, the old man fires back.
Really? What does he say?
Oh, he gives Wukong a piece of his mind, calls him, and this is quite a list, A bony-faced, lumpy-foreheaded, flat-nosed, sunken-cheeked, hairy-eyed, consumptive ghost.
Ouch. That's specific. And brave.
Incredibly brave. And he calls Wukong impudent for yelling at an elder. It shows this amazing integrity, you know? He's scared, but he still stands up for basic respect and tradition.
That's actually quite powerful. It does make you think, doesn't it? About Wukong's behavior. Is he just being impulsive or genuinely disrespectful here?
That's a good question. Probably a bit of both, knowing Wukong. He pushes every boundary.
So how does Wukong take being called a... well, all of that?
He just laughs. Brushes it right off.
Of course he does.
Tells the old man he's blind for not recognizing greatness, basically. Says, strange appearances can hide jade within. Don't judge a book by its cover, especially this book.
And knowing Wukong, I bet he doesn't stop there.
Not a chance. He launches into one of his epic boasts. Full-on self-promotion.
Ah, the resume?
Pretty much. Born from a stone, flower fruit mountain, Dongsheng divine continent, trained by a sage.
Can stir up oceans.
Subdue dragon mothers, carry mountains, chase the sun.
Bind monsters, capture demons. Subdue
stars, change constellations, steal heaven, turn earth. All of it.
Wow.
And tops it off by calling himself the infinitely transforming beautiful stone monkey.
Beautiful stone monkey. Okay. He's laying it on thick.
Completely. It's pure intimidation and awe-mongering.
And does it work? On the old man.
Instantly. It's like flipping a switch.
Right.
The old man's anger, his fear, it just evaporates. Replaced by, like, joy and reverence.
It's like that. From terrified and insulting to reverent.
Just like that. He immediately, respectfully, invites them into his home, which, by the way, is described as being secured by thorny hedges and stone walls. A simple, protected place.
So they go inside. What's the hospitality like now?
Complete 180. The old man's all smiles, gets them chairs, brings tea, bustles about preparing this big vegetarian meal.
What do they get?
Sounds pretty good, actually. Yeah. Gluten, tofu, taro sprouts, radishes, spicy mustard, turnip, fragrant rice, and this vinegar-stewed mallow soup. A proper spread.
A feast, really. And, especially after being yelled at and threatened with sleeping outside.
You bet. And guess who's suspicious?
Gonna be Baji.
Always. He pulls Wukong aside, whispering like, okay, what gives? 5 minutes ago, he was insulting your face. Now he's laying out a banquet. Why?
Baji's practical mind can't compute?
Nope. He just doesn't trust it.
And Wukong's response. Still confident.
Oh, totally dismissive. He's like, relax. This is nothing. Tomorrow he'll probably give us 10 fruits and 10 dishes.
Just like that. He expects even more.
That's what he says. But Baji's not buying it. He mutters that Wukong's just talking big again, probably trying to score a free meal, and they'll likely have to sneak out before dawn.
Oh, poor Baji. Always waiting for the other shoe to drop.
And Wukong just ends it with this line, don't worry, I have my ways.
Ooh, mysterious.
You know Wukong, always sharp. He asks about this amazing generosity.
Ah, okay. Never misses a trick.
Never. And that's when old man Lai sort of drops the bombshell.
Oh, gee.
He basically says, oh, I've heard you, son Wukong. You catch monsters. Right. Well, funny you should ask, because I've got one.
Right in his own backyard, basically.
Exactly. A monster problem he needs solving.
And Wukong, let me guess, he jumps right in.
Instantly. Doesn't miss a beat. Hmm. Bows really deeply, like he's sealing the deal then and there.
Okay, yeah, that sounds like Wukong. Just head first into the action.
It's classic Wukong, but then, of course, you've got Baji.
Oh, yeah, Pigsy. What does he have to say? Always ready with a comment, right?
Always. He immediately makes this crack about Wukong being more excited than if it was his own grandfather needing help. Always rushing into trouble is the implication.
Huh. Yeah, that sounds like their dynamic. So what is that exchange, Wukong's eagerness and Baji's cynical remark? Tell us about them.
Well, it just perfectly shows their, you know, their relationship. Baji sees Wukong as reckless, always making things complicated.
Right. Creates work.
Creates work, exactly. But for Wukong, it's who he is. It's his job description, almost, catching demons.
But Wukong's explanation for the bow is really interesting, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Because he doesn't just say, I'm keen. He tells Baji that deep bow wasn't just politeness. He actually calls it a deposit.
A deposit? Like a down payment?
Pretty much. He says, word for word almost, if he puts down this deposit, then the old man will not go ask others.
Wow. Okay, that adds a layer. It's not just impulsiveness, then.
Not at all.
It's shrewd. Almost like a business transaction, securing the contract. How does thinking of it as a deposit change how we see Wukong here?
it shows he's not just a fighter. He's, well, he's smart. He understands leverage. He knows how to make sure he's the one they rely on.
So it secures his value, makes him indispensable.
Exactly. It's strategic. It adds this layer of street smarts, maybe, to the Monkey King persona. Uh-huh. He knows how the world works.
Okay, but then the master, Tang Sanzang, steps in.
He tells Wukong, basically, hold on, don't be so rash. He asks, what if this monster is too powerful? Won't that make a mockery of a monk's word?
Ah, so it's about reputation.
It's that tension again, isn't it?
But Wukong just sort of brushes it off.
Pretty much. He just laughs, tells his master not to worry, says he'll just ask a few more questions first. Very confident.
And his next question is quite clever too, right?
Yeah, it is. He turns back to the old man and asks something like, look, this place seems peaceful, it's populated, it's not remote. How could a monster be bold enough to cause trouble for a big family like yours right here?
Hmm, good question.
This old man, he paints this picture, 3 years and 6 months of terror.
Yeah, a long time.
But he says the last 2 years were really bad. This demon just showed up, started eating cattle, horses, pigs, sheep.
Just devastating their livelihood.
And worse, swallowing chickens and geese whole, and even eating men and women alive. It sounds just relentless, unstoppable.
Absolutely horrific. And that's where Sun Wukong, the Monkey King, comes in.
The hero arrives.
They ask him for help. And Wukong's response. His first reaction is, well, a bit cagey. He says the demon is difficult to catch. Right after that, they accuse him of just being a monk who cheats for food, you know, all talk.
Ah, okay, so they called him out.
And that seems to flip a switch. Suddenly, Wukong's like, difficult. No, actually catching this demon. Easy.
Easy. So what was the difficult part then?
That, he says, is the real problem. The difficulty is that the local people, the villagers, and they are not united.
Not united. So it wasn't the demon's power, but their lack of teamwork.
Precisely. He completely reframes it. It's not about the monster out there. It's about the disorganization in here. It's a pretty harsh truth bomb.
Wow. Okay. So if that's the diagnosis, what's Wukong's prescription? What's the solution?
And it's surprisingly practical. Very clear. He says, look, there are 500 households here, right?
Yeah.
If each one just gives one tael of silver, like a standard chunk of silver back then.
Okay, one tael each.
They'd have 500 taels.
Mm.
And that, he says, is plenty to hire a real expert, someone skilled enough to sort this demon out properly.
A collective fund. Simple. Makes sense.
It seems straightforward, doesn't it? But then you get the old man's response.
But it turns out they had tried.
He's almost ashamed. He admits that every single household has already spent 3 to 5 taels of silver each.
It just didn't go well.
Oh, what happened?
Well, the old man explains. The year before last, they invited this monk from Shan'an Li.
Okay, a spiritual approach.
Yeah, sounded the part, dressed in a kasaya, you know, the robe, talking about the Peacock Sutra, reciting the Lotus Sutra, braining incense, using a bell, pulling out all the stops, basically.
So confronting the monster spiritually.
And the monster shows up, wind clouds the whole dramatic entrance, and they fight. The text says it was like punches and grabs, back and forth, chaos.
And the monk.
It ended badly. The monk, the text just calls him Bald, was beaten like a rotten watermelon and died.
Oof. That's graphic and grim. So much for their first hope.
Totally grim. And to add insult to injury, the villagers had to pay for his coffin and give silver to his disciples, who were apparently still complaining and threatening to sue them.
You're kidding. They fail, die, and the village still gets hassled for money. Monkey King's reaction.
He just sort of laughs and says something like, so you took a loss, huh? So you'd think after that disaster, maybe they'd, I don't know, give up or try something radically different.
But they didn't.
Nope. The very next year, desperation drove them to try again.
Okay, who did they call this time?
This time, a Taoist priest. He also looked impressive. Golden crown, ceremonial robe.
Different tradition, similar approach.
Seems like it. Tapping a token, using talisman water, you know, magically charged water, summoning spirits and generals to capture the demon, fought the monster all day until evening.
A longer fight, maybe more hope this time.
Maybe. But the result, just as tragic. They found him later, dead in a mountain stream, described as looking like a drowned chicken.
Oh, man. Another failure.
And again, the villagers had to foot the bill for the aftermath. It's just heartbreaking, really. They keep trying, keep losing people, and keep getting charged for the privilege. Utterly desperate and vulnerable.
It really paints a bleak picture. Monkey King hearing these horror stories.
So you took a loss there too, huh? Yeah, it shows his kind of detachment, maybe amusement at their repeated failures. But also, you can almost hear his own confidence underneath it. Like, you guys hired amateurs.
Right. He knows he's different league.
So after hearing all this, the failures, the wasted money, the lawsuits, the old man, Mr. Lay, he's understandably nervous about these newcomers.
Yeah, he doesn't want to get burned a third time.
Exactly. He's worried about being lied to again. So he suggests drawing up a proper contract or written agreement. He even calls in several other village elders as witnesses.
Makes sense. What are the terms?
Pretty simple, actually. If Monkey King and his group succeed, they can name their price, any amount of silver they want.
Okay.
But if they fail, they can't blame the villagers. No complaining, no demands for costs.
Fair enough, given their history. How does Monkey King take that?
He just finds it amusing, laughs again, and says something like, wow, this old guy must have been cheated a lot. It shows he gets why they're being so cautious.
But then the elders actually see Monkey King for the first time.
Yes. And their reaction is not great.
What do they say?
They're visibly startled. They look at him. Monkey King is often depicted as relatively small, maybe a bit odd looking. And they basically say, he's inadequate.
Ouch.
Yeah. They literally say his small, thin body is not enough to fill the monster's tooth gaps.
Huh. So they're judging him purely on appearance after seeing fancy robes fail twice.
It's very human, isn't it? But Monkey King, naturally, has a comeback. Classic self-assuredness.
What's his response?
He tells them, look, I might be small, but I'm solid. He claims he's eaten sharpening water and has inner spirit. Basically, don't judge a book by its cover. I'm tougher than I look.
Love that eaten sharpening water line. So the elders, presumably still skeptical, but maybe intrigued, they get back to the agreement.
Right. They ask the big question, the one that caused problems before. Okay, what about the payment? If you succeed, what silver do you want?
Then here comes the twist, right?
Oh, it's a huge twist. Monkey King just flat out refuses any money.
Refuses, after they said he can name any price.
Yep. He says, gold dazzles the eyes, silver is silly white, copper coins smell fishy. He declares they are merit-accumulating monks. They do good deeds for spiritual credit, basically, and they don't want any money.
Wow. Okay. That must have thrown the elders for a loop.
Completely. So they try another angle. If not money, maybe. Property. An endowment.
Makes sense. A lasting reward.
They offer him 1,000 mus of prime farmland. A mu is about 1/6 of an acre, so 1,000 mu is huge. A massive amount of land.
Wow. Where would they get that?
They propose each of the 500 families contributes 2 mus from their fish farms. Enough land to build a whole monastery. A permanent legacy for the heroes.
That's a seriously generous offer. Surely he accepts that.
Nope. He turns that down too.
Seriously? Why? Yep. What's wrong with land and a monastery?
His reason is incredibly practical, almost mundane. He says owning land means duties. You have to raise horses for service, pay grain tax, work constantly, not sleeping at dusk or dawn. He says it would be troublesome to death.
So no lofty spiritual reason like earthly possessions or a burden, just too much paperwork and chores.
It's really too much. It's so unexpected. It completely reframes what he, and by extension maybe what true heroism, values. It's not about wealth or status symbols. It's about, well, not being bothered with admin, apparently.
That's amazing. So he's turned down a fortune in silver, turned down a massive estate. What do they ask for? They must want something.
They do, and it's incredibly simple. Monkey King just asks for a cup of tea and a meal.
That's it. After facing down a monster that's terrorized them for years, just tea and a meal.
That's it. And you can just feel the elders' reaction. Relief, delight, probably disbelief, too. This incredibly simple, humble request, it just changes the whole dynamic.
It absolutely does. It completely redefines the idea of a hero's reward. Okay, so the deal is struck. Basically for hospitality. But the elders still seem worried about the monster itself.
Yeah, they make one last attempt to impress upon Monkey King how serious this is. They describe the monster again, really dramatically this time.
How they put it.
Reaches heaven, reaches earth, comes with wind, leaves with mist. You know, emphasizing its immense size and supernatural power.
Trying to make sure he understands what he's up against.
Exactly. And Monkey King's response, just pure, unwavering confidence, almost dismissive.
What does he say?
He basically says, look, if it's a demon that messes with wind and mist, piece of cake, I treat those like my grandkids. If it's just big, no problem. I know how to beat big things.
Total confidence, no fear, completely capable, maybe a touch arrogant, but you know, he can back it up.
That's Monkey King in a nutshell, isn't it?
Sun Wukong, chatting with elders.
Powerful wind just tears through, and the elders, they freak out. This monk has a salty mouth. talk of demons, and the demons arrive.
Huh. The old man yells for everyone to get inside.
Even the holy tongue, Sansang, and usually brave Zhu Baji Pigsy and Xiao Wujing Sandy, they flinch. They try to back away, head for cover.
But Wukong, nope, he's having none of it. He physically grabs Baji and Xiao Wujing, drags them out into the courtyard. He's like, what's wrong with you two? You're monks. Don't you know inside from out? Stay put. Come with me and see what this thing actually is.
That is so Wukong. Everyone else panics. He's immediately analyzing, ready to confront whatever it is.
And what it is. I mean, the description of the wind alone.
Mm-hmm.
It's incredible. The sources get really poetic.
Oh, yeah. It talks about it uprooting trees and destroying forests, causing wolves and tigers to worry.
And stirring rivers and disturbing seas, causing ghosts and gods to fret. It even says it overturns mountains, lifts continents.
It's biblical, almost. This force just descends, plunging the village into total darkness, black clouds blocking the stars. Just gloom.
That scale tells you right away, this isn't just some minor demon causing trouble. This is something bigger.
And the reactions keep coming. Baji's is just perfect. The text says he's so scared he literally buries his snout in the dirt as it's nailed down.
Oh, man. And Xiao Wujing
just covers his face. Total fear. But amidst all this, Wukong, ever the observer, spots something. Two lights way up in the sky.
Ah, yes. And this bit is gold. Baji, still probably shaking, sees the lights and completely misreads the room. He laughs and says, how fun. A well-behaved demon. We should be friends. He thinks they're lanterns.
It's hilarious. Such a moment of pure Baji mixing terror with this weird optimism, or maybe just cluelessness.
Definitely cluelessness there. But Xiao Wujing, always a bit more sensible, cuts him short. You're wrong. Those aren't lanterns. They're the demon's eyes.
Imagine Baji's face dropping. He cries out, Grandpa, if its eyes are that big, how big is its mouth? Suddenly, it clicks. This isn't just scary, it's enormous and fundamentally different.
So those massive eyes are the cue. Wukong knows it's go time. He vaults into the air, ready to fight it alone. But first, he tells Baji and Xiao Wujing, protect the master.
Smart move. Always thinking strategically, even in the heat of the moment, prioritizing Teng Sanzang's safety.
And the monster's fighting style.
Yeah.
This is where it gets really strange.
Right. It doesn't talk. Wukong shouts at it, you know, where are you from? Stuff like that. But the monster just attacks fiercely with a long spear.
And Wukong actually notes he's truly deaf and mute. That silence is bizarre. And as it turns out, a huge clue about what they're dealing with.
Yeah, a hint about its nature long before the big reveal. The fight itself goes on for ages, apparently.
Yeah, the sources say they battle way up in the air until like 3 a.m. No clear winner. But Baji, watching from down below, he notices something important.
What's that?
The monster's only defending, just parrying Wukong's staff, which Wukong keeps aiming at its head. It's not really pressing an attack.
Hmm, interesting. Defensive posture. That suggests, well, something. Maybe it's not purely aggressive or its power works differently. And of course, Baji sees the stalemate and thinks,
my chance for glory. Exactly. He wants the credit, the first cup of wine, as he puts it. So he jumps into the fight, rake ready.
Typical Baji, always looking for an angle.
And this is where that weird weapon detail comes in, the soft handle spear. Baji's fighting it right. And he sees the spear tip, but he can't see the handle properly. It seems soft. Or somehow indistinct.
Ooh, soft handle spear. That sounds odd.
Very odd. Wukong initially kind of dismisses it, but then maybe thinks twice. And another one of those subtle clues. Easy to miss, but really important later.
And Wukong puts these clues together, doesn't he? The silence, the defensive fighting.
He does. He comes up with this brilliant deduction. He figures because it can't speak, it hasn't fully returned to humanity. It's still full of strong yin energy.
Ah, the yin-yang element. That's central to the philosophy in the book, isn't it? Yin being dark, passive, feminine energy. Yang being light, active, masculine. Demons often represent that imbalance.
Exactly. And Wukong's genius is often seeing that underlying energy dynamic. So based on the strong yin energy, he predicts what will happen.
What's the prediction?
That the monster will have to retreat at dawn. When the sun rises, the yang energy will become too strong for it.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to be ready to chase it the second it breaks.
Clever. Using its fundamental nature against it.
And sure enough, first light hits, that yang energy rises,
yeah.
And poof, the monster turns and flees fast, just like Wukong said.
So the chase is on, Wukong and Baji take off after it. It really shows Wukong's intellect, figuring that out from just those few clues.
They follow it to this place called Seven Jew Mountain, mm-hmm. Specifically an area known as Sparse Persimmon Thorns.
Okay.
But it's not just the place, it's the smell. They hit this wall of just foul, overwhelming stench.
What kind of stench?
Well, Bodgy, never one to mince words, immediately gags and yells, "Whose house is cleaning a latrine? This stench is unbearable."
Uh-huh. You can just picture him. So relatable, that reaction to a truly awful smell.
Totally. But Wukong, even though he's holding his nose too, he's focused. Quickly, quickly, pursue the demon. He knows they're close.
That stench has got to be another clue, right? Pointing towards its less refined nature.
Bingo. And then the big reveal. The creature they've been fighting, the source of the wind, the silent spear wielder. It shows its true form.
And it is.
A python. A massive red-scaled python. And the description is just wild.
Lay it on us.
Okay, get this. Eyes like morning stars. Its nose spouting morning mist. Teeth like dense steel swords. Claws like curved golden hooks.
Wow. Sounds formidable.
Oh, it gets better. It has this fleshy horn on its head like thousands of gathered agates. Its whole body is covered in red scales like millions of layered rouge.
So visually stunning in a terrifying way.
Yeah. When it's coiled up, it looks like a brocade quilt. But when it flies, people might mistake it for a rainbow.
A rainbow. That's quite a contrast with the stench.
Right. Its resting place gives off that sky-piercing stench. And when it moves, it's shrouded in red clouds. And the size. It's immense. So large people couldn't see east or west past it. So long it spanned a mountain north and south.
It's unbelievably huge. No wonder Bodgy was worried about its mouth size earlier.
Exactly. And Bodgy, true to form, cracks a joke even now. If it wants to eat people, it'd need 500 for a meal and still be hungry.
He never quits, does he?
Never. But here's the crucial part. Wukong has the aha moment. He realizes what the soft-handled spear was.
What was it?
It's tongues. It's two long tongues, the text calls them. That's true. That's what Bodgy saw, flickering like a spear tip, but without a solid handle.
Whoa, okay, that changes everything about the earlier fight. The softness wasn't the weapon, it was the creature itself.
Precisely. It shows Wukong connecting all the dots, the silence, the defensive moves, the weird weapon, it all clicks into place. And that means a new strategy.
Right, because now he understands its physiology better, so what's the new plan?
Well, the python tries to escape again, slithering into this narrow cave. But it's so big, it leaves like 7 or 8 feet of its tail sticking out.
An opportunity.
Bodgy thinks so. He grabs the tail, tries to haul the massive thing out. He pulls with all his might.
Oh, wow.
Doesn't budge. Not an inch. He's yelling, "It's stuck! It's stuck!" Total failure.
Okay, so brute force isn't working. Time for Wukong's brain again.
You got it. Wukong sees Bodgy struggling and figures it out. The cave's too narrow for this giant snake to turn around inside.
Ah, so if it went in head first.
It must have another way out, a backdoor exit.
Yeah.
So Wukong comes up with this clever trap. He tells Bodgy, "You run around to the back exit and guard it. I'll attack from the front."
Sounds like a solid pincer movement.
It should have been. So Bodgy sprints off to find the back hall. As soon as he's gone, Wukong jabs his staff into the front entrance.
Okay. Provoking it.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
The python, feeling the poke, shoots out the back exit like a rocket.
Uh-oh. Is Bodgy ready?
Not quite. It happens so fast. The python bursts out and smacks Bodgy with its tail, knocking him flat on his face before he can even react.
Ouch, that's got a sting. Mostly his pride.
Totally. Wukong comes into the now empty cave, calling out like, "Let's chase it." Only to find Bodgy scrambling up, red-faced, dusting himself off.
And what's his excuse this time?
He starts flailing his rake wildly at the grass and bushes, pretending he was busy, claiming, "Just beating the grass to startle the snake."
Oh, Bodgy. Trying to cover up his blunder. Classic.
So the chase continues. They track it across a ravine. The python seems cornered now. It coils up, opens that enormous mouth, clearly aiming to swallow Bodgy.
This is it. The final confrontation.
But Wukong? Talk about bravery. He sees it going for Bodgy, and instead of letting his companion get eaten, Wukong charges forward and gets swallowed himself. Deliberately.
Ooh. He sacrifices himself.
Seems like it. Bodgy is devastated, starts pounding his chest, stamping his feet, crying out, "Brother, you're lost. It's over." Looks like game over for the Monkey King.
Man, that's intense. But knowing Wukong, this isn't the end, is it?
Not even close. And he actually yells out to Bodgy, who's still outside, obviously.
Yells from inside the monster.
Yeah. Tells him something like, "Watch me make a bridge."
A bridge? Okay.
Well, he uses the rod, applies pressure, forces the monster's body, and suddenly this massive serpent arches its back way up high.
Ah, so the monster becomes the bridge.
Exactly. The text calls it a domhom, like a rainbow-like bridge. You could just imagine Baji seeing this giant snake suddenly contorting into this arch.
Must have looked bizarre.
Totally. And Baji, being Baji, apparently mutters something like, it looks like a bridge, sure, but nobody's going to walk on that.
Always practical, Baji. But Wukong isn't just making shapes for fun, right?
No. He's testing, manipulating, and he's not done. Next up, he reverses the pressure somehow, forces the monster's belly to flatten out.
Flatten out into what?
Into something like a boat. They call it a ganbao boat in the text. So first a bridge, now a boat.
A monster boat. Okay. This is getting weird.
And again, Baji has a comment.
Oh, I bet he does.
Something like, well, it looks like a boat, but it's got no mast, no sail, not going anywhere.
He's got a point, I guess. But Wukong must have an answer for that, too.
Oh, he does. And this is where it gets really clever. This is the masterstroke.
Okay, well, I'm ready.
He takes that iron rod.
Yeah.
And shoves it straight up, right through the monster's spine.
Whoa! Through the spine.
Yep. Hardcore. Makes it stick out the top by 5 or 7 zege. That's a huge length, maybe 16, 20 feet, like a mast.
He made his own mast out of the monster's spine and his rod.
Precisely. Yeah. It's brutal, but incredibly effective. Because now the monster is in absolute agony.
I can only imagine. What does it do?
It tries to get away from the pain, right? Yeah. Just bolt. Propels itself forward like crazy.
Using its own pain as fuel?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
The text says it shoots off over 20 li back down the mountain. That's like 6 miles or so. Just pure pain-driven speed.
Until
it just collapses. Dies from the trauma, the exertion, everything. Wukong essentially turned it into its own self-destructing escape vehicle.
Wow. And Wukong just pops out.
Yeah, crawls out through a hole he presumably made.
Yeah.
But you also get this great Baji moment afterwards.
Oh, yeah.
So Baji eventually catches up to the massive dead python. And what's the first thing he does? He starts hitting it.
You know him too well. He starts whacking the carcass with his rake. Wukong, who's just drilled his way out, asks him, why are you hitting it? It's dead.
And Baji's reason.
Pure gold. He says, brother, you don't know. I, old pig, have loved beating dead snakes my whole life.
Uh-huh. That is the most Baji line ever.
So, okay, back in Tuolu Village. The villagers were apparently beside themselves, right? Wukong and Baji didn't come back overnight.
Yeah, they feared the worst, understandably.
But then, boom, Wukong and Baji show up dragging this massive snake. You can just imagine the relief, the cheering.
Oh, absolutely. And the source really drives home how grateful they were. They believed this python was genuinely hurting them, taking people. So seeing it dead, they basically saw the monks as like divine saviors, bowing, thanking them profusely.
They wanted them to stay for days, didn't they? Like 5 to 7 days.
Yeah, they tried offering feasts, everything.
Right.
But the monks, you know, they're on a mission. They were reluctant to stay too long.
And since the monks wouldn't take money, the villagers got practical. They loaded them up with dry food, fruit, provisions for the road.
Right. And the send-off, it's kind of amazing.
It really is. The text says 700 to 800 people from 500 households.
Yep. Mules, horses, banners, flags, a whole procession to see them off. It shows just how much impact they had, even in a short time.
But then, trouble ahead.
Exactly. The road leaves them to the Seven Absolute Mountain, Scarce Persimmon Hollow.
Catchy name.
Yeah. But the problem isn't a demon this time. It's the path itself. It's described as being completely blocked by, basically, just filth and stench. Impassable.
Like physically blocked by muck.
Pretty much. Repellent stuff. And you have to think, on a spiritual journey, this kind of blockage, this filth, it often means more than just physical dirt, right? It can symbolize, you know, spiritual obstacles, too.
You can feel the impact on the team. Tang Seng apparently smells it, sees the road blocked, and just asks, Wukong, how do we get through this?
And even Wukong, who's usually unstoppable, admits, yeah, this is difficult.
The source even says Tang Seng starts crying. That really hits home how bad it must have seemed. Just this disgusting, overwhelming barrier.
Yeah, it's a moment of real despair. And it raises that question, you know, what do you do when the path itself is just repulsive?
So the villagers, still grateful, they offer to help, right? They say they'll open a good road for them.
Bless their hearts, yeah. But Wukong, he's the pragmatist. He gives this witty reply, basically saying, look, you guys aren't you the great divine army.
The flood tamer.
Exactly. He tells them, you can't clear an 800-line mountain path. That's like, what, 400 kilometers? He says, thanks, but no thanks. This one's on us.
Okay, so if the villagers can't do it, how do they tackle this? It sounds impossible. And frankly, gross.
But Wukong comes up with a plan,
mm-hmm.
a very specific plan. And it's maybe not the most heroic sounding task.
Go on.
It involves Baji.
Ha! Pigsy? Why him?
Because Wukong figures Baji needs to eat. a lot, like a huge amount, mm-hmm. then transform into a giant pig.
A giant.
A truly massive one. And use that powerful pig snout to just plow through it all. To yeah. arch open the old path, as the text says. Shove all that filth aside.
Wow. Okay. So the ultimate dirty job.
Pretty much. And Wukong knows Baji is uniquely suited for this. Physically, yes. But maybe, you know, character-wise, too. He's the earthy one.
How does Baji take the suggestion?
Huh. Not well, initially, he complains, right? Why me? Why do I always get the smelly jobs or something like that? Why do you only teach old pig to make a stench?
Yes, can't blame him, really.
No. But Tang Seng steps in. He's smart. He offers Baji the first credit for clearing the path if he succeeds.
Clever. Does that work?
It does. And then Baji actually explains his own powers, which is fascinating. He says, look, I've got 36 transformations.
Okay.
But, says, I'm rubbish at the light stuff, flying things, elegant shapes. Nope.
So no delicate fairy transformations for Baji.
Definitely not. But, he says, transforming into big, heavy, earthy things. Mountains, trees, rocks, rhinos, buffaloes, even camels. He's like, I nail those.
So he's perfect for becoming a giant earth-moving pig.
Exactly. But there's a catch, he points out. When his body gets huge, his stomach gets even huger. He needs a massive amount of food to power the work. It's not just brute force. It requires serious fuel. It shows that sometimes you need that grounded, raw power, not just clever tricks.
And the villagers, what do they make of this?
Oh, they're all in. As soon as they hear Baji needs food, they're like, we've got food. We've got stuff. They just start piling up everything they brought. The dry rations, fruit, cakes, dumplings.
They just empty their bags for him.
Totally. Yeah. It's all for you, they say. Their support is just unwavering. It's quite touching, actually.
So Baji gears up for this transformation.
Yeah. The text describes him taking off his monk's robe, tossing down his famous rake, getting ready for the unpleasant task.
And the description of the transformation.
It's wild. Really vivid. Mouth long, short hair, half fat and lean. Black face, round eyes like sun and moon, round head, big ears like plantain leaves.
Wow.
Bones hard as heaven's age, coarse skin like iron fortress, snoring nose, four white hooves 1,000 feet high, sword-like mane, body 100 feet long. Just this colossal creature.
Got 1,000-foot high hooves, 100-foot long body. That's immense.
Truly monumental. And you really see the teamwork kick in here, too.
How so?
Wukong immediately starts directing things. He tells the villagers, pile the food here. Tell Sha Sing, take off your shoes, carry the luggage carefully, make sure Tang Sing is secure on his horse.
Keeping everyone safe and focused.
Exactly. And crucially, he tells the villagers, go back and get more food. He knows this isn't a quick job. Baji's going to need refueling.
And the villagers, they do it. Go all the way back.
They do. The village is over 30 liners away, right? That's like a 60-plus line round trip, maybe 30 kilometers or more each way.
That's a long way to go for more food.
But the ones with horses and mules. The text says they flew back to start cooking. The 300 or so on foot waited at the mountain.
Wow.
And then they traveled through the night. They caught up with the pilgrims the next day, over 100 lands, further on, shouting, we brought food! We brought food!
That is some serious dedication, just incredible support.
It really highlights that bond, doesn't it? Between the holy travelers and the ordinary people they help.
So Baji works for 2 days straight clearing this path.
Nonstop, plowing with that giant snout. And afterwards, he eats 7 or 8 stone of rice, all kinds, just inhaled it.
7 or 8 stone, how much is that even?
A lot. A stone is usually 14 pounds, so upwards of 100 pounds of rice. Maybe more, depending on the historical measure. Just a staggering amount.
Fueling that incredible effort.
Exactly. And once the path is finally clear, the job done. Tang Seng, Wukong, Sha Sing, they thank the villagers immensely. A real moment of shared success before they finally continue on their way.
It's such a unique solution to a unique problem. And the chapter ends with some powerful lines, right?
Yeah, it summarizes it beautifully. Let me find the gist. It talks about the villagers returning home, Baji clearing the mountain through pain.
Tom Singh's sincere heart, Wukong's magic.
Right. The 1,000-year-old scarce persimmon is clean today. The 7 absolute hollow is open this day. And then the key part. The 6 desires and worldly feelings are all cut off, safe and unimpeded. They bow to the lotus platform.